We're going to talk all things South American football today, and I'm delighted to say that we are ready and set for our guest of the Thursday's show. He's a man who, whenever we need to talk South American football, we love to get on because we can just listen to him for hours on end. He's only got about 20 minutes or so with us, so however much we'd like to make it, a couple of hours. And joining me on World Football Daily today, on the line right now, is Mr. Tim Vickery, BBC South American football correspondent and all-round football journalist legend. Tim, it's a pleasure to have you on board today, mate. How are you on this fine day?
Yeah, lovely to be here. Interested that you were doing a Brazilian game last night. I was at a different Brazilian game from the one that you were commentating on. And something happened in that game that I thought was hysterical that I'd love to share with you. It was Flamengo of Rio at home to Bahia. And Flamengo have a kind of stand-in coach. He was a player for the club a few decades ago called Jaime de Almeida. He's been in charge since the former national team coach, Mano Menezes, resigned about a month ago. And there was a big banner that some of the fans had put on the stands there. Jaime, we are with you. And then we're inside the last 10 minutes. The score is 1-1 and the visiting team, Bahia, are dominating. And then Jaime de Almeida makes a controversial coaching change. He takes off the star midfielder, Elias. He brings on a defensive midfielder, Val. The whole stadium is booing and jeering. And then I look over to where that banner is, and the fans are taking it down. They're not with him anymore. Jaime, we're not with you anymore. You've made a substitution that we don't like. A minute later, Flamengo scored the winning goal, and then hurriedly the supporters have to try and put that banner back up again. That was the fickle mentality, especially of the Rio supporter, but of the Brazilian supporter, and to some extent the South American supporter, in just a few minutes. I thought it was a lovely story. I'd like to share that with you.
Oh, fantastic, Tim. Always enjoy your tales from the leagues from around South America. Just quickly, actually, let's touch on the Brazilian Serie A at the moment, because of course, at the moment, Cruzeiro absolutely running away with this title, 10 points ahead after 29 games, just a handful of matches remaining in the season. But it's that battle for second, third and fourth that's really hotting up between Botafogo, Atletico and Grêmio as well. Who in your mind, in these going into the final run, eight or so games of this season, do you think is in the best position to maintain those Copa Libertadores spots, of course, with fourth place taking the going into the Copa Libertadores qualifiers?
Well, those teams that you mentioned there, Botafogo, Grêmio and Atlético Paranaense, have a nice little cushion. Next, I think, coming up behind is Atlético Mineiro, who, as Libertadores holders, are already qualified for next year. So they've got a little cushion against the teams immediately below them. And the most fascinating aspect, I think, of the Brazilian championship this year is who's going to go down, because you've got a situation when we're well into the final straight now, the last third of the competition, and even the team in like sixth place can't totally be assured that it's not going to get relegated. You know, you've got 15 teams of 20 looking over their shoulder worrying about being relegated. It's been a strange year. It's confounded the prediction. Certainly it's confounded my prediction, because I was expecting differences to really start opening up, because money is coming in. Although even some of the big clubs have huge debts, now that the resources of the big clubs are much, much, much greater than the resources of the smaller clubs. But you've got, just say, in the city of São Paulo, and São Paulo's having a bad championship this year. But Portuguesa, who are a tiny little club who struggle to put 3,000 in the stadium, you know, they're doing better than the likes of Corinthians and São Paulo. The drama in the Brazilian championship, I don't think is going to be so much at the top this year. I think it's going to be at the bottom. You know, who is going to go down? And the game that you commentated on last night, Fluminense. Now, Fluminense are the reigning champions, but they're really, really in the dodgy stuff now. And Fluminense, I'll be at the game on Saturday with Fluminense against Ponte Preta. And that's now a game of two clubs desperate to pick up points and avoid relegation. But you could say that about so many games in the Brazilian championship. So the fun and games, I think, are at the bottom of the table this year and not at the top.
And aside as well, that many people kind of, especially in the UK, kind of spring to mind from when Manchester United were in the Club World Cup. Vasco da Gama, who had a very solid year last year and had almost switched over now, right in the thick of that relegation battle. A number of people highlighting the loss of Dede and the impact that that's actually had, not only on Vasco, but on Cruzeiro as well, who obviously brought him in this year and have rocketed right up to the top of the table and are storming away with the league. How much of an impact has that loss been on Vasco, do you think? What else has gone wrong for them this season?
Well, it's obviously been it's made a huge impact, but it's symptomatic of problems that everyone knew Vasco had. I think everyone knew Vasco were really going to struggle this year because they are one of the big clubs in absolute financial turmoil. And that's the reason that they had to sell him. They had to sell Dede, and Dede didn't really want to leave. But he was explained to him that, look, you know, we've got to have to sell you because that's the only way that the club workers are going to get paid this month and next month. And, you know, paid for 3 months ago that we still haven't paid them for. So I think Vasco's problems were predictable. And the problems of the likes of Corinthians and São Paulo, I think, have taken people by surprise. But everyone expected Vasco to be in for a difficult year. And Dede, as you said, he started... It was a bit of an awkward start there with Cruzeiro, but he settled in very nicely and got back in contention with the Brazil squad. He scored, in fact, against Zambia on Tuesday, and that will have done. And his overall performance will have done him a power of good. And Cruzeiro have that defensive solidity now with him. He's strong and very, very quick across the ground. But also Cruzeiro going forward, they've scored many more goals than anyone else. But if you look at the list of top goal scorers in Brazilian football, they don't have one anywhere near the head of the goal scoring charts, which shows that their goals have been shared around a wide variety of attacking options. And that's, I think, one of the reasons for the fact that Cruzeiro are the runaway leaders, because with that pause for the Confederations Cup, it's meant that there's game after game after game to catch up all those fixtures that we couldn't have in June and July. Mm. And a lot of people are dropping by the wayside tired. But Cruzeiro, that they've got such a range of attacking options that they could pick two attacks without a noticeable drop in performance. And that, I think, has been a key factor in, it looks like, the likely championship win for this team.
Tim, we also need to talk about Brazil 2014 and the World Cup. And it was astonishing that on Tuesday night we had all the celebrations for England here in the UK, and of course plenty of teams wrapping up their World Cup qualification process and booking their place to Brazil next summer. Yet on the streets of Rio, huge protests once again. More questions being raised about possibly whether Brazil can deal with hosting this World Cup. What are the thoughts down in South America, down in Brazil at the moment, about the lead up to this World Cup now? Is it getting tense at all?
Well, I think that protest movement is now part of Brazil's DNA, and it's not going to go away. It took everyone by surprise, the extent of the protests in June and July, the wave of protests all over the country. It didn't start about investments in the Confederations Cup and the World Cup. It started on the issue of public transport in São Paulo. Mm. But that is linked, because there's no doubt about it, they've made a mess of World Cup organisation. They haven't taken the opportunity that was there, and they haven't invested in things like public transport to the extent that they should have done. It's a missed opportunity. And the fact that the stadiums are coming online in general very impressive just makes things worse. You know, how can we have such an impressive stadium when our public transport is poor, our public education is poor, and our public health is poor? That glaring contrast just makes things worse for the authorities. During the course of that, of June and July, increasingly the spending on the state spending on the football tournaments became part of the front line of that protest movement. And there's no sign of that going away. I would think it's pretty much a racing certainty that we're going to get mass protests during the World Cup, especially bearing in mind the fact that the Confederations Cup, we had 6 cities. The World Cup will have 12 cities, including the more controversial ones like Cuiabá, like Manaus, where, you know, they don't have big, important football teams. You wonder what on earth they're going to do with the expensive stadiums that are being built there. And there was a protest last week in Cuiabá. Jerome Valky, FIFA Secretary General, was on a visit to check stadium work. And before he could get to the stadium, a number of protesters had broken into the stadium and daubed slogans all over the walls of the stands. So it's going to be a really tough one, I think, for the authorities next year, because the eyes of the world are upon them. And they really have two almost contrasting necessities. They have to protect people's right to protest peacefully, But at the same time, they're going to hope that that doesn't interfere with the tournament. And the stakes are much, much higher than the Confederations Cup. And a Confederations Cup, we had between 2 and 3% of tickets sold to non-Brazilians. Come the World Cup, there'll be hundreds of thousands of foreigners wandering around the country just to add to the mix. So it's going to be... Well, it's going to be a wonderful time to be alive as a journalist because, you know, we're going to have an excess of stories to cover. I hope that people can protest because there's lots to be protested. There's lots to protest about. I hope that the country can change. But I also hope that we get a great World Cup because I think football needs it. It's going to be, I think we're going to be living in interesting times.
It's going to be a very peculiar summer indeed. Just quickly before we look at the World Cup qualification and the final table in South America, Tim, what about this Qatar issue of the 2022 World Cup? There's been a lot of talk obviously about it. In early October there was a discussion by FIFA about possibly moving it to the winter, and the European leagues have obviously stood their place and said that they're not big fans of having a winter World Cup. What about the attitude down in South America towards the moving of that World Cup to the winter in Qatar?
It would cause far, far fewer problems over here. And winter is high summer over here, and that's when football shuts down. You know, it shuts down from, depending on the country, either early December to kind of late December, and doesn't get started again, apart from the odd tournament here and there, doesn't really get started again until February. So a European Winter World Cup really doesn't cause too many problems here in any way. In terms of the way that the calendar is organised, there's usually more flexibility because they don't have the centuries-old tradition that there is in Europe of when the season starts and when the season ends. So there's more of a flexibility on this issue. So this is an issue which is much more between FIFA and the major European leagues than it is about the South American leagues.
Does it help that a number of the South American leagues, of course, have the kind of Torneo Inicial and that second sort of league, the league's almost split into two individual tournaments? Would that make it easier as well for any movement that there needed to be because they can just spread out the gap between those two tournaments?
Yeah, perhaps. But if it's going to be kind of January, then that's a time when there's no football over here anyway. So it really does... doesn't interfere with the way that things are done here anything like as much as it does with the way things happen in Europe. And this I suppose, is, you know, ever since 1974, when the Englishman Stanley Rowse lost the presidency of FIFA to João Havelange, FIFA power base has not been in Europe, and FIFA has globalized considerably since then. And this seems to me to be a raising of the ante of that dispute, almost like the rest of the global forces against the major European leagues. And it's going to be interesting to see which way it plays out.
It will be interesting to see both how the next summer and, of course, Qatar 2022 do change the footballing landscape in international football. Of course, we had the finale of the South American World Cup qualification, Uruguay, going into that playoff game as Ecuador, Chile, Colombia and of course Argentina booked their automatic places to the World Cup. And a lot of talk, we were talking about it before these games, about this Colombia side. There are plenty of people that are saying that this could be as good or possibly even better a side than 1994's side that was pipped possibly to at least make the semi-finals, some people predicting. Are you in firm agreement with that, Tim, or do you slightly think that this is an overreaction?
Well, I love the 1994 side. I feel it's one of those teams which is victims of an injustice because they collapsed during that World Cup under pressures that were really extreme, and they were representing a country that was falling apart at the time, and there were other circumstances such as the loss of their goalkeeper. But they were a great side, the Colombia side of 94. This is probably the best side that they've had since then. There's some work, though, I think, for the coach Peckerman to do between now and the World Cup, and some hard decisions, I think, for him to take. And Colombia, during this campaign, they went a long time without conceding goals. And I could never really work out how that was, because the defence always looks a little bit rocky to me. And that defence has started leaking goals. And he's got a decision to make about the captain, Mario Yepes, who is coming up 38, has been a truly, truly great player. That centre-back there, but he's starting to creak. And yet the lack of pace of Yepes now means that he likes to position himself very deep. He's also liable to pick up cards. But positioning himself deep means that there's a hole between the defence and the midfield. You worry about Colombia in that aspect. You also worry about Peckerman. They've just gone off the boil a little bit, I think, Colombia. And I think Peckerman, the coach, would love football to be a 12-a-side sport because ideally he'd like to pick 12 in order to have Falcao García as a centre-forward, plus another striker there, Gutierrez, to work the channels because Falcao García's build-up play is not good. He would also want Cuadrado wide on the wing, wide right, just to stretch the defence. He wants James Rodriguez to play a roving role, both in the centre and out left. And he wants the passing of Magnelli Torres, who's a wonderful playmaker, who really can play that killer pass. But he wants all that with a couple of defensive midfielders to give him solidity. And you add it all up and it comes to 12 players. So I think there are some there are still some hard choices for Peckerman to make at both ends of the field. So I'm not quite as up on Colombia as I was, say, 6 months ago. I think they've just gone off the boil a little bit. Although there's time for Peckerman to get things right. And there is a very interesting generation of players there, but there are still a few question marks against them, I think.
How up are you on Uruguay? Obviously, finishing the qualifying round with that win against Argentina, Luis Suarez with the penalty in controversial style. They've been all over the place in World Cup qualification. Almost their goal difference of zero shows how up and down they've been. But taking on Jordan, not to get past Jordan, would be an absolute travesty, would it not?
Apparently so, yeah. And I was speaking to someone the other day who was at the game between Jordan and Uzbekistan when Jordan, I think, won 9-8 on penalties to book their place in the playoffs. And he was telling me it was the worst game of football he's ever seen in his life. And whoever got that playoff space would more or less have a bye. We'll see how that one pans out. You'd certainly expect Uruguay to get over the line with that one. It's an ageing side, Uruguay. They started this qualification campaign. It's a marathon qualification campaign. It's taken over 2 years. They started very well. Then they had an absolutely disastrous time in the middle when it looked as if even the playoff spot would be beyond them. What got them over the line? They won away to their direct rivals for that playoff space, Venezuela and Peru. Now, they're great, great victories, especially in the context of a competition that's had 41 home wins and 13 away wins. To win away to your direct rivals, they're great, great results. And underpinning that, I think, was a recognition of the limitations of the side by the coach, Oscar Washington Tabárez. For a while, they were trying to play football. They were trying to elaborate. I think Tavares has realised, firstly, that this is an ageing side. And apart from the strikers, Cavani and Luis Suarez, this is a side which has grown old together. It's really a side that's been together since the Copa America of 2007 in Venezuela. And the World Cup, assuming that they make it, will be the swan song for many, many members of that side. So it's an ageing side. And also, it's not a side, strikers apart, it's not a side with a great deal of talent. And if you remember the World Cup, when they reached, again, after coming fifth in South America, they came fourth in the world. In the World Cup, in every game, the opposition had more possession. But I think in every game, maybe bar one, Uruguay had more shots. And Uruguay went almost like back to those basics in the home straight of the qualification campaign. Defending deep to protect the lack of pace in that defensive unit. Plenty of space there for them to slip Luis Suarez on the break against terrified defences. And that's the format, I think, for Uruguay. Defend deep, counter-attack. It's not always easy on the eye, but Suarez in full flight is a magnificent sight. They are a great tournament team. I think they're a better tournament team, Uruguay, than a team for a league format. So they'll expect, assuming, of course, they'll qualify, they'll expect to do well in the World Cup, and no one needs reminding them what happened last time the World Cup was played in Brazil. But you do just wonder if too many components of that team have got old together. So it's going to be a battle, I think, for Uruguay. I think it'll even be a battle getting out of their group, although if they do get out of their group, once they're in that playoff, that sudden death tournament format, never, never write them off. But I'll be a little bit surprised if they manage to emulate what they did in South Africa, because, as I say, this side has grown altogether.
And finally, Tim, just to kind of wrap up South American qualification for us, there are two sides that maybe haven't received as much press as we've given others in this round. Of course, Argentina, Colombia, Uruguay, Ecuador. We've discussed a little bit on the show in the past, Tim. But what about Chile? Because I was looking back at the table and almost didn't notice them there in third place, if you will. This is a Chile side that, for me, I personally have kind of had under the radar. Do you think many other people have been like that, or have I just been a little ignorant of this Chile side that's done very well in this qualification tournament?
Well, they wobbled badly in the middle of the campaign, and then they changed their coach, and it came little electric, little Argentine Jorge Sampaoli, who looks like he works on batteries. The way he wanders up and down his little technical area. And Sampaoli is a disciple of Marcelo Bielsa, who, of course, took them to the World Cup in South Africa, where they were the neutrals' favourite because of the style of football. They're even more likely to be the neutrals' favourite this time because it's the same style and it's wonderful to watch. High tempo, never likely to be one of those teams that just go to the World Cup to clatter it up. They want to make an impression. They want to impose themselves on the opposition. They don't defend particularly well, and their method of defending is to try and strangle the opposition in the opposition's half of the field. And in full flow, they're the most attractive side in South America. And even Argentina are wonderful to watch, and Brazil can have their moments, but Chile in full flow, are a terrific side to watch. The advantage that they've got over the side that Bielsa took to South Africa in 2010 is that was a young side. Those same players are now 4 years further down the line and they've really matured. And Arturo Vidal was a promise 4 years ago. He's now the powerhouse in the Juventus midfield. Alexis Sanchez was a promise 4 years ago. He's now, especially this season, he's really showing it. In fact, he was terrific in the air against Ecuador on Wednesday night. That's another facet that he's added to his game. I can't see them going all the way in the World Cup. I simply think that their defence isn't good enough. But I can see them winning hearts and minds all over the place because they're going to be one of the sides that you just can't take your eyes off, because while Chile are on the field, there's always something happening.
Is there going to be an expectation for them to get out of their group? Obviously got through the group stage in South Africa and, as you say, impressed many. But will that expectation now have been raised, not exponentially, but greatly after last time going into the World Cup? They hadn't won, I think it was since the 1960s, won a World Cup game.
I think there's an expectation not all the South American sides to get out of their group. Any of them that doesn't get out of their group will clearly be seen as failures. I mean, Ecuador, the last time they qualified for the World Cup, that's in Europe, in Germany in 2006, they got out of their group. And they beat Poland there, which was practically a home game for the Poles, and they gave England a tough game in the second round. So in their own continent, and Ecuador with and Luis Antonio Valencia flying, and on the other flank, Jefferson Montero is just a little bit of calm and composure away from being a global superstar. Ecuador also, I think, a theme with the crop of South American teams who've come through the qualifiers is that they all attack better than that they defend. And Brazil, who haven't been through the qualification campaign, look to have the best balance between attack and defence of all of them. But certainly all of them are attractive sides, and all of them will be very, very disappointed if they can't make it out of their group. You know, the first time that they've had the World Cup in their own continent since 1978, they will have big response from their public. You know, there's been a big take-up of tickets, certainly from Argentina, from Colombia, from Chile. You'd expect it from Uruguay and Ecuador as well. Well, you know, I mean, Oliver Bierhoff, from the former Germany centre-forward, now working for the German FA, he was over here for the Confederations Cup, and he came to the conclusion that he doesn't think a European side is going to win next year. If he's correct, then the South Americans, the big South Americans, are certainly going to be there or thereabouts.
Are you saying that South Korea can't do it, Tim? I won't have you say anything of the sort. Tim, hopefully the South American sides do provide that attacking flair that we've wanted from World Cup football and has maybe been lacking over the last few tournaments, that's for sure. And we hope that you'll stick with us in the build-up to Brazil 2014 to provide your expert journalistic flair that you provide for World Football Daily, mate. We appreciate you taking the time to have a chat with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Tim Vickery, joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things Brazil 2014 and a little bit of the Brazilian Serie A as well, building up to the World Cup next summer. And of course, South American qualification over, apart from Uruguay's playoff game against Jordan. Argentina topped the group with 32 points, Colombia 30, Chile 28, Ecuador 25, Uruguay 25, but that plus four goal difference of Ecuador's.